Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, could your private sector retirement fund be sacrificed to protect the public sector's gold-plated pensions? The latest budget speculation has workers worried. Also today, Lee gets on his soapbox about a couple of taxes that really get his goat. Where will interest rates be this time next year? There is some debate. Should you get a LISA if you already own a home? And where are the UK's property hotspots? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, another day, another budget speculation story. This time, it's about private versus public sector pensions. Could there be a raid on private sector workers' retirement funds in the budget while gold-plated public sector pensions are protected? Now, according to This Is Money calculations, the raid could cost a 30-year-old private sector worker on the average salary £13,000, or 5%, of their eventual pension pot at the age of 67. Simon Lee, welcome. Simon, firstly, before we dig right into this one, just explain about public sector pensions and how they work.
Okay, Georgie, I'll do my best because this is a complicated topic. And I'm guessing that the Chancellor was thinking that this was a topic complicated enough that potentially people wouldn't notice the extra tax rise here. Unfortunately, this has blown up, become a major story. And as we talked about last week, and I don't want to rehash old ground, but I think that putting employer national insurance contributions on pension contributions is a uniquely bad idea. Most people in the pensions industry think it's a uniquely bad idea. David Blunkett, who was one of the architects of auto enrollment, came out and said it's a uniquely bad idea. And there are a number of reasons for that, and we'll have to sort of unpick it. But I think just headline level, this comes from what I would call the running out of options budget, which is that having announced that she needed to raise a large sum of money and having ruled out raising a number of taxes in their manifesto, the Chancellor and Labour are rapidly running out of options because things keep getting floated and people keep shooting them down. And this is the latest one to get shot down. Now, what triggered the big row this week over this, because this national insurance on pension contributions, the eagle-eared will notice, is not this week's story, but this week's story was the emergence of the suggestion that the government would reimburse public sector organisations for the extra costs, because the impact would be that it would either potentially fatally undermine those very same public sector pensions, which are obviously extremely highly valued by the people who are accruing them and the people who work in the public sector, and rightly so, and potentially trigger a new wave of strikes and disputes. But also, if not, it would require the public sector employers to divert more money into the pension funds, which would then lead to more cutbacks in services, which is obviously what we all don't want, because services have been cut back pretty much to the point where they can't be cut back anymore. And we can't blame the current government for that one. We have to blame the last one. Okay, just to be absolutely clear, we are an equal opportunities blame assigner on the This Is Money podcast. The last lot caused a whole load of trouble, and the new lot came in promising to fix the trouble and spent their first 100-odd days causing some more trouble. So there you go. That's where we're at.
Fair.
But to go back to your question, public sector pensions, what's the big difference? The big difference with public sector pensions is that they are defined benefit pensions. A defined benefit pension does what it says on the tin. The benefit that you get from that pension is defined. You pay some contributions in, your employer pays some contributions in. But what you are not doing is what people in the private sector, who where defined contribution pensions now dominate, do, where that money then goes into an investment pot. It's invested over time. You take the investment risk. You have a sum of money at the end, and then it's on you as the worker to turn it into an income in retirement. In the public sector, and with a defined benefit pension, what happens is for every year you're a member of the pension scheme, you will accrue a portion of your salary. And then at the end, you will get that chunk of your salary, and you know, over that whole career that you've been working there, paid out to you every year for the rest of your life in retirement with some other valuable benefits attached to it. And it is on the employer to provide that for you. So the employer takes the risk versus with defined contribution, the employee takes the risk and the employer just contributes to it. And I read something the other day where someone said, basically defined contribution pensions aren't really pensions at all. They're just a tax incentivized savings scheme, which is kind of, you can't really argue with that much. Whereas a defined benefit pension genuinely is a pension. Most people in the private sector used to benefit from defined benefit pensions, but they became very expensive. Stock market returns declined, very, very low interest rates, low gilt yields, a number of bad decisions made by successive governments over the years led to effectively companies deciding that they were too expensive and winding them down. And it's worth noting that most defined benefit pension schemes used to be final salary schemes, but in order to try to make them affordable, employers, initially in the private sector and then now more so in the public sector, shifted from final salary defined benefit pensions to something called career average, where what you're doing is you're, instead of paying out a percentage of someone's salary on their last day in the job, which tends to be the highest that they'll ever earn in the job, you pay out a percentage of their salary earned over the years that they're in there, and so it averages out their wages over their career. So if we give an example of the teacher's pension scheme, in the teacher's pension scheme, workers pay in between 7.4% and 11.7% of their earnings, and that rises depending on their earnings. So the highest earners, they pay in more. So at the top end, the head teachers will be paying in 11.7%, right? That's a chunky amount, right? Bearing in mind that auto enrollment is you paying 5%, and even generous company pension schemes, people might be paying in 6 or 7. So paying in between 7.4 and 11.7 is a lot. But what they get for that is their employer contributing a sum worth 28.68% of their salary each year. Okay. So the most generous private sector schemes might potentially double what you put in up to a certain amount. You put in 5, they put in 10. In this instance, the employer, the state, is putting in 28.68%. In return, teachers accrue 1/57th of their pensionable earnings for that year, including any overtime, which is handy, that bit. The scheme means that after 40 years, a teacher could have a guaranteed annual pension income worth 40/57ths. So every year they've done it, 40-year career, they earn a 57th. That's roughly 70%, 40/57ths of their career average earnings. And the fact that that is guaranteed is why these are called gold-plated pensions. It's because they have to keep paying that to you for the rest of your life, and it's on them to do it. And it's, you know, anybody who's got an existing private sector defined benefit pension, which most of them you can't accrue any new benefits, but those pensions, you know, that people have retired on at the moment, people are getting, they are absolutely great, right? They are really good schemes. They are protected. You know, there are limits. You can lose some of it if the pension scheme goes bust, but they are protected. The former employer has to take all of the responsibility for paying it, and it is so much better than the defined contribution schemes everybody else is in.
I imagine this is sort of quite politically a big issue.
It's very politically charged, because ultimately what you're doing here, if you put national insurance on pension contributions, which currently doesn't exist, is you are imposing a tax on pension contributions. We need to encourage people to save more for retirement.
Why? Sorry, Simon, back. Why are they even proposing that? It seems the most ludicrously cynical, like, backward step. If we try, like you said, if we're trying to get people to put more in, I mean, you are desperate if you're looking to do that, aren't you?
To raise money. to fill the black
obviously,
hole.
But
but this it does illustrate the foolishness of it. I sat down yesterday with somebody. We had a meeting. We were talking about newsletters, okay? And he said to me, "But what do you want to do with the newsletter? You know, we're talking about improving This Is Money newsletter and This Is Money newsletter service, right? Sign up to it. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/newsletter. If you listen to this and you haven't signed up to our newsletter, do please sign up. We put a lot of effort into it every week and we think it's really good. And if you don't like it, you can always unsubscribe. Anyway,
you can have some suggestions.
Plug over. But the point was, what do you want to do? Mm. What's the point of this? Is it because you want to do this or is it because you want to do that? Or do you want to do a combination of these things? And I think with some of these things, it's the what do you want to do here? Do you just want to fill this hole because you said there's a hole and so therefore you need to fill it? Or do you, or do we want people to be saving for retirement and that's a long-term plan? And do we want to potentially scupper some of the long-term plan for the short-term plan? Now, this is not a cut and dried thing. We don't definitely know that this is going to happen in the budget. In fact, there are suggestions that it's not going to happen in the budget and it's speculation. The problem is, again, not to rehash old ground, but we have had so much speculation due to the fact that a vacuum was created by the announcement of the black hole on the last day of July or whatever it was, and then just months of people speculating. And you know, it hasn't been shut down either, quite a lot of this stuff. And then some of this stuff quite close to the budget looks like the kind of kite flying that's coming from the Treasury, floating ideas and things like that. Well, we might do this, might do that, and then they see how much it gets shut down. So hopefully this won't happen, but the fact that it's even being discussed is foolish, because as we said, we're trying to get people to save more for retirement.
Yeah.
Literally the whole thing with auto enrollment at the moment, and this is what David Blunkett said, is we're trying to get employers to pay more into people's pensions, with private sector employers. Mm. You know, the calculations you talked about, okay, this is a very, very hypothetical calculation that we did, because it is not absolutely clear that if national insurance of 13.8% is imposed on pension contributions, employers will cut pension contributions by 13.8%, because they might not do that, because pension contributions, for a start, they see them as a good thing. They also use them as a recruitment and retention tool. You've got to consult on these changes. It takes time to put through. It's expensive to do. But they might trim back in the future, and say an employer decided to suck some of it up. But just in the future, they went, okay, well, we'll cut what we put in by 10%, okay? Which actually isn't that much money, right? It's the difference between, say somebody has an employer who matches 6%. It's the difference between, you know, £350 a month going into their pension, 6% from the employee, 6% from the employer, and £332 a month going in. But once you do that over, you know, say 37 years, right? From 30 to 67, for someone who starts on £35,000, the contributions go up with inflation and so on. It ends up being £13,000, their eventual pot. It's 5%. That's not a huge amount, but actually, you know, that's the difference between a £257,000 pension pot and a £244,000 pension pot. And that pension pot's not going to buy you the comfortable income that the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association recommends that you need. So there's all of these layers of the onion and knock-on effects going on here. And the other thing I would say is also that what we don't want from this, and this quite often emerges in these stories, okay, is it shouldn't be a race to the bottom either. Just because people in the public sector get better pensions, right, and there'll be people listening to this who are going, hands off my public sector pension, I really value it. But just because they get better pensions doesn't mean we should try to drag them down to the level that everybody else is at. We need to drag people up to the level that they're at. And people in the public sector work really hard. Some of them do very taxing and very difficult jobs. I, for one, personally wouldn't want to be a teacher and don't think I could necessarily, I don't think I could cut being a teacher for 40 years, to be honest. I'd be absolutely exhausted at the end of it, and I would damn right think that I had earned my pension, okay? So, yeah, but what we want to do is try to get employers back to the point where they're giving people those better pensions rather than dragging everything back down to them. And the only thing that I can see, you know, this suggestion of national insurance on pension contributions is doing is dragging the whole system down and creating more division and more rows And, you know, somewhere down the line, the private sector pensions get a bit worse rather than a bit better. The public sector pensions get a bit worse rather than a bit better, and nobody's happy. And
Quite.
there'll
So,
only be another black hole at some point in the
well,
future.
quite,
Like, I mean,
quite.
do we genuinely believe that if we plug this one, there's never going to be another one?
It's all right. You just fiddle the figures. Look, so Steve Lee isn't a fan. So Steve Webb, Baroness Altman, she's not a fan. Lord Blunkett, King Simon's not a fan. Is anybody a fan of this, Lee?
I don't know if there are. Who's come out
What's
and
the
said that?
argument?
Who's
Like, is there
come
anyone
out
coming
and
out
said
and
that
saying yeah?
they're a fan of this? I mean, we've got Ros Altman here, former pensions minister, saying
Mm.
ending employer NI relief, especially if only for private sector, would be disastrous and a serious mistake. Steve, also former pensions minister and also our pensions agony uncle, he's not quite as kind of spicy with his language
He's a measured man, isn't he?
as
Measured man.
it's taken more of a kind of measured approach to this. But again, you know, he's warning against this. And I think that it's, you know, I kind of felt like towards the end, especially of the Conservative reign, a lot of it was about the sort of generational battle, you know, older people versus younger people. Why are we now pitting people with private pensions up against people with public pension? I mean, is this the new kind of
I
we're kind
know.
of like going to be angry with each other? And as Simon said, I think the real measured thought process for this is how do we bring people up? You know, don't drag. Let's not drag people down. And it's you know, I think if you look at the reaction of our reader comment section, which if you're a regular reader, this is money. You know, it tends to be quite well measured responses in our comment section, and sometimes it can go into a kind of real wild west of you know, people getting quite upset about things. I mean, the vast majority of people just cannot believe that this is even an option that's come out and being considered. And I think that, you know, we were talking about this in the podcast last week, weren't we, about the kite flying. There's kite flying, and then there's sort of having a kite being like torpedoed out of the air. I mean, it's just sort of it's kind of, and the other thing is, like, there's been obviously a lot of rumors ahead of this budget. But
No,
why
tons.
what's the obsession with things that are so complicated to kind of try and wrestle and, you know, kind of undertake in your first budget? Yes, you know, Rachel has stuck to this line of the black hole, and whether it's 20 billion or 40 billion between friends, who knows what the black hole truly is. But, you know, it's kind of attack the right things. I just, you know, how do you implement this in a kind of first term of parliament, you know, within the first few months? It just seems unnecessarily complicated and messy to me. So is this kite going to fly? Oh, I'll tell you what, if it does, I know a man that is embedded and has a deep intrinsic detail and knowledge of this now, Mr. Lambert. You know, not saying that he didn't before, but even more so. So next week, if this does happen, I know who I'd be
Yeah.
trusting to edit and write a story about it.
Good to know. Good to know. Before Lee, I do get you to rant about other things as well. I mentioned there, Simon, about we could just fiddle the figures. But that's not quite so ludicrous. Can you just explain for the lay person what does that mean? That Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has changed the debt rules so we don't have a black hole?
The idea behind this is that this will not remove the black hole. The black hole is still there. But what it will do, it will mean that we are not trying to scrabble around to balance the books in a way that means we continue to cut investment in things that are important and become objects of value or services of value to the country. So, for example, infrastructure, railways, roads, energy, reservoirs, all those kinds of just the stuff that you sort of need. And that kind of spending actually can be positive economically, but also means that we basically have the framework that we need to be a successful country. And, you know, if the trains run on time, if the roads aren't congested, if the broadband works, if you've got the grid connections to connect your renewable energy to, rather than pushing for renewable energy and then not being able to connect it to the grid. If you've got some unpopular things that people are not going to like gas pipes and pylons and stuff like that, Housing comes into this as well, although, you know, obviously the onus of that is going to be on the private sector to do it, but it's all the connections for the housing and things like that. This is all seen as, you know, the things we need to get growth going. The stuff that Labour was banging on about, right, about how they're going to turbocharge growth. What you don't want to do is sap that by imposing overly restrictive debt rules on yourself. So she will introduce a new investment debt rule. And it should free up more than £50 billion in borrowing space to fund long-term capital spending projects. Rachel Reeves confirmed this at an IMF meeting this week. What she said she would not do is use this money to cover day-to-day spending. It will not go on public sector pay rises and such like. It will be governed by strict guardrails. And the risk here is what you want to do is you want to balance the fact that clearly you need to be investing in order to improve. And arguably, for many years, we should have been borrowing some more money when money was super cheap to invest in some of this stuff rather than cutting back. That was always one of the major criticisms of austerity, for example. But what you don't want to be doing is the markets to be seeing you as just borrowing more and more money in order to fund your country's day-to-day spending, because they won't like that. And then they will demand higher interest rates on government debt, and it will cause gilt prices to spike, and then the cost of our debt will rise because we're spending more money on servicing that debt. And the cost of servicing our debt at the moment is a major issue for the country and many countries around the world. So that's the idea behind this, basically. Mm.
Thank you, Simon. I mean, you mentioned there the markets. It's almost like it's a person or people. Well, it is people, isn't it? But they obviously had something to say after the sort of Liz Truss budget. So we know that it has impact. What are the markets making of this budget, Simon, and all the speculation? And
the
all
markets, that nebulous concept, are watching this with interest. They're not febrile. They're not worried. They're not ready for a spike or a sell-off or anything like that. There's no kind of like panic moment kind of thing, but they are watching this. And this, again, is a kind of self-created issue. To be honest, the market reaction to the election of the government was really good. Bond yields fell. People bought UK shares. People backed the idea that change of government, new people in charge, new ideas, greater degree of competency than some of the people who had been in charge before, would lead to, you know, improvements in Britain's outlook, and, you know, international investors and the large amounts of money they control were willing to back it. Unfortunately, the first hundred odd days hasn't been great. It's been very gloomy, and markets have now got a bit worried about the fact that maybe there isn't a particularly good plan here and it's not really going to work out. I think, to be honest, budget's going to be absolutely fine. Markets are going to react slightly. They always react slightly, but we're probably going to be in a similar position to where we are now in a month's time, probably a better position, because then markets will know what has happened. They will know what Labour has said they're going to do about tax, what they're going to do about spending, what's going to go up, what's going to go down, and markets like certainty, and then we can all move on from this.
Marvellous. Hear, Simon. Right. As I sort of intimated earlier, it's becoming a bit of a regular feature for us. Simon's Soapbox and Lee's Let Rip. See what I did there? I mean, if you can think of a better L, Lee, then that's great. But I thought Lee's Let Rip could work because today it's Lee's turn. We know about stealth taxes. We talk about fiscal drag on our wages. That's one of them. But Lee's decided to take aim at some others. So Lee, love, the floor is yours. Have a good moan. Let it all out.
I've written a piece this week just about two taxes that have sort of crept up upon us. And I think that, you know, the everyday public might not be fully aware of these two taxes that are kind of eaten away and have grown from a couple of billion quid not that long ago to almost £20 billion a year. I think that's quite a hefty sum of tax that we are paying. So I kind of called them, I labelled them secret taxes. Of course, they're not secret taxes if you listen to this podcast or if you're a regular reader of This Is Money. But I kind of dubbed them a secret tax because I've had so many conversations this year. And I promise you, I'm not a boring guy. I promise you, Georgia, I promise you I'm fun at parties. But I do sometimes just like to sort of, you know, someone starts to turn the conversation into money, knowing what I do. I do sometimes just do the sort of test on, you know, do you know about your personal savings allowance? And Do you know about insurance premium tax? Just because I do just love to throw it in. I do. I honestly, I reiterate, I'm fun at parties. I used to be, Georgie. I used to
I
be.
believe it. I
I
believe it,
used to
Lou.
be. I used to be.
Just
So
certain parties. Yeah.
talking about savings interest taxes. So it's the amount of tax that you pay on your savings interest, and depending on how much you earn, you get a varying degree of an allowance. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast, but basically basic rate taxpayer, £1,000, you can earn an interest for tax free, and then higher rate, £500, and the additional rate, you don't get any. And we kind of, I think if you listen to this podcast, you know about this, but you might not know just how much that this is now starting to take in. So there were some stats this week from Coventry Building Society saying that for this financial year, the bill is set to be 10.4 billion pounds, and savers will contribute a greater share of income tax receipts in this tax year than any time since 2007, 2008, at 3.45%. That's chunky, because if you go back only a couple of years, 2021, 2022, that was at 0.61%. Big leap, £9 billion leap. Of course, a lot of that has been driven by higher savings rates. So look, we're getting a proper return on our cash. But I think it's really important to know that you do get that balance eaten away, and it's a particular problem for additional rate taxpayers, but it affects absolutely everyone that saves, and saves a fair sum at the moment. So I think that figure is really big. And this, I know we've just gone on about the budget next week and Labour. This has got nothing to do with Labour, and they're not going to do anything about this in the budget. I should reiterate, I'm not asking them to sort of make massive changes to the PSA, but we did, the previous government, we did put some pressure on about basically being a little bit more generous with the PSA, perhaps giving additional rate taxpayers a little bit of an allowance, maybe giving them £500 and then boost everyone else's by £500. We of course have ISAs, and ISAs are our tax-free friend. Now they have been in the news this week. So do you remember on Friday when I said I'd had a bit of a kind of vision? I'd wake up in the night worrying about ISAs
You
for
did.
absolute no reason other than that
You did,
Resolution
Lee.
Foundation suggestion earlier in the year about £100,000 lifetime cap on how much you could put into an ISA. So an ISA, you could put £20,000 in every year. There's no cap, there's no kind of upper limit on this. But there was an unearthed column from Rachel Reeves that was written in 2016, where she argued for a £500,000 limit on ISAs. So essentially, they are back in the spotlight. Could that happen next week in the budget? We still have no idea what's gonna be in there. We asked a lot of savings experts, and they kind of said don't think this could happen. But I'm not ruling anything out. So I think that dream, and also the Coventry Building Society stats, kind of got me into writing about that. Now the other tax that I mentioned in this column is the insurance premium tax, so IPT. I went real bee in my bonnet about this one, Georgie. I wrote about it last November, when essentially the take of IPT was up to 7.45 billion for the 2022-23 financial year. It's gone up again this year, another 9% to £8.1 billion a year. Now, if you're sitting there listening, going, "What on earth is IPT?" It's just a general a tax on general insurance premiums for car, home, pet, and it's charged at 12%. And I don't think anyone really has a clue about it. So it basically gets lumped onto insurers, and insurers just pass it on to us people, law-abiding citizens that insure our cars, and it's been part of the reason why it's driven up the cost of insurance. Now, I went back and sort of dived into figures of this. So, yeah, this was a real George Osborne move, this one. So I'm not this. This is really, is a George. I don't say a George Osborneism, of where he kind of tried to sort of up the tax take without people kind of wising up to what it is or what it does. And I think IPT is a classic one of that. So it's gone up from 2.5% when it was introduced in 1994, so 30 years ago. It was cranked up it stayed there all the way till 2011 when it went up to 6%. Then there was gradual increases all the way up to 12% in 2017. But between 2002 and 2011, the total IPT bill was just £2 to £2.5 billion. You know, far slimmer than it is now. And even 10 years ago, it was just under £3 billion. And I thought it was quite interesting because the Transport Secretary, Louise Hay, tweeted last week saying, car insurance is an essential, not a luxury, but the rising cost of cover has hit drivers hard. Today, I've launched a task force to give this the attention it deserves. We will root out the factors driving up costs to ensure drivers get a fair deal. Well, I tell you what, have a look at IPT, because that's, you know, hitting people hard. It's probably hitting younger drivers the hardest because they already face insurance bills of thousands and thousands of pounds. But will that get changed? Will that get tinkered with? Well, of course it's not going to get changed or tinkered with, because it is where it's at now. And, you know, it just, nothing will happen with it. But those two taxes I thought were worth mentioning this week, Georgie. 20 billion quid they've snowballed into, up from a couple of billion not so long ago.
Look, I go back to the question that I asked before, and the answer was to get money. But it seems a little bit unfair when you're taxing people for doing the right thing. I understand we don't want loads of people to put all of their money into the savings, because I get that's probably not good for the economy if everybody's just stuffing stuff away. But still, it feels nasty, these ones, you know?
I think they feel nasty, Georgie. I mean, I think the IPT one's nastier than the savings interest tax, just because, you know, there is a way around the savings tax,
yeah,
for savings interest tax for a lot of people, which is the ISA allowance. But it's just when you start wealth building and getting down further down the line where you might be in a position where, lucky you, you're maxing out your ISA, and that kind of thing, where it kind of starts to become difficult to sort of circumnavigate this. And actually, we've always had in the This Is Money savings tables the effective rate depending on how much tax you're going to potentially pay on your interest. So, you know, I think a lot of people just do not understand the concept of, this is the rate of interest on your savings account, but if you earn this much interest on it, actually the effective rate is this. And it kind of, a lot of people that I speak to, going back to when I've mentioned this to people, just have no idea that they're taxed on their savings, mm-hmm, in this, mm-hmm, way. And a lot of people that I speak to that are taxed in their savings this way have gone off and had a look, realising that they're just not maxing out their ISA. And I do think that a lot of people are way more clued up and have been more clued up in the last year or two, when you only have to look at ISA inflows and how much money is going into tax-free accounts, to realise that people are getting more clued up to this and potentially trying to shelter their wealth ahead of this budget and the Labour government. But even so, I thought it was just worth noting, you know, A, trying to spread more awareness about these two taxes, but also just the awareness of there are some that it is bringing in for the Treasury.
That's it, part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, here's a question on growth. Will the IMF boosting the UK's growth forecast be good for the UK stock market?
Well, a growth upgrade is good news, but it's probably not market moving news. The International Monetary Fund raised its forecast for UK economic growth to 1.1% for 2024, an upgrade from its July prediction of 0.7%. But to a degree, that's telling us something we already know or suspect. So according to the official measures from the Office of National Statistics, the economy grew by 0.7% in the first quarter of 2024 and by 0.5% in the second. And so far, the numbers have shown it was pretty flat in the third quarter. So that effectively gets us to about 1 and a bit percent in terms of growth that we've already seen this year. So what the IMF is basically saying is that the second half of the year is going to be pretty much flat. So while that's better than an economic downturn, it's not exactly going to set pulses racing. And it's worth noting, too, that the IMF didn't alter its forecast for 2025, which is still 1.5% for the year. So overall, the UK economy has been resilient, I think, to the much higher interest rates that we've seen in recent years. And it's probably doing a little bit better than some predicted, but it's not really making all that much progress just yet. As for whether that is good for the UK stock market, I think those growth expectations are largely baked in already. which is why I say it's not particularly market moving. There's also the fact that the UK stock market is not the same thing as the UK economy. The biggest companies in the FTSE 100 are mainly international earners, so they're not that sensitive to UK domestic growth. It's growth on the world stage and within their particular respective industries that matters to them. However, for many smaller and mid-sized companies, the growth of the UK economy is more important, as they would tend to be more domestically focused. So if there is an impact felt by growth numbers, it's among those smaller businesses, which are less reflected in the major stock market indices.
So it's pretty much steady as it goes, which takes us back to the UK stock market. Why do people say that UK shares are cheap?
So when investors refer to shares as being cheap or expensive, that usually relates to their price as measured by their share price or overall company valuation versus their earnings, how much profit they make. So if a company is valued, say, at 10 times their earnings, that's half the price of a company that's valued at 20 times its earnings, for instance. So it could be considered cheaper. So it's in terms of this price to earnings ratio, the UK is very inexpensive compared to other markets. The overall average for the FTSE is 12 times earnings. That compares to, say, 22 times for the US market and 19 times for the global market average. However, there is cheap, and there is cheap for a reason. And the reason investors might not want to pay as much for UK shares is that the growth in earnings going forward could be less than in other markets, which makes them less attractive. So there could be a good reason for the discount, but that said, many people think the UK discount is undeservedly wide, and there's a lot of room for UK companies to surprise on the upside in terms of their earnings growth going forward. And if that's true, then it's likely that the UK market is a decent place to put some of your money for the long term.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Now, Goldman Sachs this week has made a rather bold prediction about interest rates, suggesting they could fall to 2.75% by the end of next year, something that has raised the collective eyebrows, especially as Santander has said they expect rates to fall to 3.75% by the same time, but remaining between 3 to 4% for the foreseeable future. So what is behind these predictions and who, Simon Lambert, is right?
Well, I would say, as someone who thinks that interest rates need to be back near a more normal level and settle there, that I would hope Santander were more correct than Goldman Sachs. But from a purely selfish point of view, as a man whose fixed rate mortgage comes to an end in September next year, I hope Goldman Sachs are right. Who knows? These things change around all of the time. What I can say is there has possibly never been a time when more people were keenly watching this, because they are in situations like mine, or in situations where their mortgage is coming up for renewal much sooner. And we have got a nation of amateur, you know, rate forecasters as never before. I mean, obviously, we had a real boom in this after rates were cut following the financial crisis. And there was forecast that they'd go up. And then they never went up. And then people lost a bit of interest. But you know, the old rapid interest rate rises to quell inflation, which may or may not have quelled inflation. Inflation might have just gone away anyway, have really sparked a lot of interest in this, largely off the back of the fact that people are staring down the barrel of paying monthly mortgage payments that are hundreds of pounds higher, and they would like as little as that as possible to feed through. So markets at the moment, and you know, markets are an aggregate measure of what different forecasters and economists and experts think is going to happen, are generally suggesting that we're going to get another one or two rate cuts this year. So we've got a decision in the first week of November. One is expected then. Do we get another one in December? Don't know. And then that we're going to see some more next year, and that rates will settle at around kind of 3.25, 3.5%. Market's consensus is about 3.5% by the end of next year. But that, you know, inflation could keep dropping straight through the 2% and continue down. And if that happens, the economy slows, get a load of tax rises, The threat of tax rises slows the economy more. The Bank of England might be forced to cut by more, or inflation might spring back a bit. Economy might pick up. Bank of England might decide, well, we don't need to cut anymore. We can stay where we are. You've got to watch what the Federal Reserve does over in the US. That's the real key to this. And if the Federal Reserve starts very aggressively cutting, then we're probably going to have to make more cuts, even though it might not quite be 100% right for us. What I would say is that between now and the end of both of these predictions, which is the end of next year, I fully imagine Goldman Sachs and Santander to make a slightly different prediction. If they're predicting the exact same thing in a year's time, I will be surprised.
I'd be quite pleased, I think. Do you know why? Because I think, not to be negative, but the world's a bit of a mess at the moment. And if anyone's noticed, it's been a bit of a mess for a while. And it's a little bit, I don't know, there's some things that are a little bit nervy for me, Lee Boyce. So anyone that makes these predictions about where inflation's going to go, where interest rates are going to go, I think it's a punt in the dark at the moment.
It is a pun in the dark, Georgie. And actually, I was just going to say this. So the Goldman Sachs forecast came out earlier in the week, and there was a lot of mortgage brokers that kind of then came out with some quite like angry comments about, you know, this being quite eyebrow raising. Someone said that economic forecasting is about as reliable as British weather. Now, the reason why they've got a little bit cross about that is because, you know, it gives an expectation that rates and mortgage rates are going to fall. And so it might tempt people into making decisions or holding off on remortgaging or buying a home. So that you can see why that makes them a little bit angry. And then we got this from Santander because our mortgage reporter, Ed Magnus, met up with Graham Seller of Santander. Now, the reason why I mention his name is that Ed reliably informs me that he listens to the This Is Money podcast every Monday morning. So hi, Graham, if you're listening to this. This 3.75% rate prediction comes from him and Santander. But actually, interestingly, he says he predicts it to stay between 3 and 4% for the foreseeable future, essentially saying that ultra-low base rates of the last few years is now truly a thing of the past. So that 3 to 4% rate is what they're predicting for quite a long time. And what that would mean for mortgage rates is that quite possibly this is where mortgage rates are settling at. And we've mentioned it a couple of times in podcasts in the last few weeks that swap rates have been sort of inching a little bit higher, hence why we've seen a little bit of repricing, not major, but some repricing from some of the lenders. So lots of this kind of future interest rate cuts are sort of baked into the mortgage pricing. So, yeah, I do like this, though. I like this sort of, like, it's not, we haven't pitted this as Santander versus Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Maybe this should be a new regular feature every week. We get, you know, two big financial powerhouses to come out and give us their interest rate predictions, and they can take the gloves off and fight.
Rate fight.
Oh, that is good. Oh,
why I'm stop there?
I'm quickly going to go in there. I'm going to go and buy the domain for that. Rate fight. Oh, yeah, nice. I like it.
I mean, it could work. Lee, meanwhile, you're talking about mortgage rates. House prices. We haven't spoken about house prices in a while, but actually the average house price rose 2.8% over the past year, according to the latest figures from the Office for National Statistics. But then, as we know, it all depends on where you live. There is one area in the UK where prices shot up 9.7%, Lee, reveal all. Where are the UK property hotspots?
Lovely. So, yes, we've got the data here that basically the past year, as you say, 2.8%. This is official stats from the ONS. And we've got Hamptons to crunch the ONS data to sort of give a spit out where the kind of 10 hottest and 10 kind of, you know, coldest house price gains and losses are around the country. So, Northeast Derbyshire, Georgie, there we go. 9.7% they've gone up in the year to August. Now, the reason why these figures are up to August is because ONS always works slightly behind. The figures always work slightly behind all of the other major house price indexes. But we have Northeast Derbyshire at number one, 9.7% growth up to £239,000 in the last 12 months. The map of where prices have risen the most in the last 12 months is a real kind of hodgepodge all around the country. It's not concentrated into one area. So number two is West Dunbartonshire in Scotland. Then you've got Monmouthshire, which is in Wales. You've got Cherwell, which is in the Midlands, Winchester, North Lanarkshire, Stratford-on-Avon, Cheshire East, Newark and Sherwood, Cumberland, all dotted all around the country. All have had growth of between 7 to 9.7% in the last 12 months. Now, there was a trend that we did spot on the other way, though, and that is that house price falls are quite concentrated to the coast. So do you remember there was that real boom in people wanting to have this kind of, you know, vision of moving to the seaside and, you know, kind of the romantic notion of what that entails? When I always think that living on the seaside, having had a lot of family that lived in North Devon, and using, I used to go to North Devon quite a lot out of season. So, you know, like February half terms and April half terms to go and see my dad who lived there at the time. It was wet and wild off that Atlantic. And I'm not quite sure if it was for me, even though I do live quite close to the coast here because I'm not far away in Essex, different kettle of fish. That's bad pun. Having a look through the list here, Adour is number one. Is that how you pronounce it? Adour?
I was about to ask French. You the same thing.
Adour. Adour. which is on the south coast. That's had 3.9%. Fall. Thanet, 3.9%. Portsmouth, 4%. Maldon, which is close to me here, 4.1%. Hammersmith and Fulham, not on the coast, but that was down 4.2%. Castle Point, which is really close to me here, which is part of Canvey Island, 4.6%. Ipswich, 4.8%. Torridge, 5.7%. Dover, 6.4%. But the biggest fall is actually where my dad lives now. My dad's like, I feel like he's kind of got in here. Rutland, 7.8%. Down. So again, that's the other one that's not on the coast. But I think it's always interesting to see what kind of is happening across the kind of property market and what's happening, you know, in terms of your local area. And that's what we kind of try and do with these sort of pieces where, you know what's happening probably locally in your local area, depending on property type, depending on what's happening, you know, developments and all of that kind of thing. And I always find it endlessly fascinating to look at these maps, but maybe you disagree.
No, I do. And I think what's particularly interesting about, sorry, Sam, I think about what you said for the first map, the property hotspots, is I actually Googled while you were talking there, the distance between West Dunbartonshire, the most northerly location, and the south, the one most south in Winchester. It's 415 miles and it is evenly spread across the middle of the country there. Is a lot of that, though, due to, I mean, some of it obviously is the fact that it's come from quite a low base. And so therefore the proportion would be higher. But places like Winchester, I think not so much. But I do remember post-pandemic, we were talking a lot, or during the pandemic, about Rutland prices going up, for example, people really wanting to go live there. Still very expensive though. Simon?
Yeah, those the fallers are the classic race for space locations, I think. You know, there was as Lee said, there was the dash for the coast and the race for space. These were two like pandemic things of, right, get out of the city, get some fresh air, get some space, don't need to go to the office. Oh no, I have to go back into the office. Scenarios, but also retired people. I think it's worth, you know, taking into account there was a lot of people retired or coming up to retirement who took advantage and moved. And people think of, they don't necessarily think of Thanet as being, you know, that desirable. But Thanet includes Margate, which was hotspot central, and Broadstairs as well. And the area around there. So again, that is the classic kind of dash for the coast kind of thing. And Rutland was very much race for space stuff. Also, I should say that we described Northeast Derbyshire as a rural Midlands hotspot. There will have been some dispute over whether Northeast Derbyshire is a rural Midlands hotspot in the office between the firmly southern me and Lee Boyce and the firmly Midlands Helen Crane on the team, who would have probably said it was in the Midlands, whereas me and Lee would have gone, it's in the north.
Yeah, a very southern view there. It's definitely the Midlands is our Derbyshire. Anyway.
It's got north in the name and it's further up than Luton.
Was it above the Watford Gap or something and that's all north?
Yeah. That's, again, things that lots of people don't know. There's so many people in this country that think the phrase above the Watford gap refers to stuff above Watford. And they're like, well, that's clearly not the north. Watford's got a tube station. It's like, no, Watford gap's not in Watford.
Anyway, sticking with property and reader question time. Why do I sense this is something to do with you, Lee? Lysers. Lifetime Isas. Basically, husband and wife, got their own property, wanting to know, as they career towards their 40th year, should they get a lifetime ISA? Or would they be better off putting $4,000 a year somewhere else? I'm going to go to you, Lee, and ask you, first of all, remind us about the LISA.
Before I remind you about the LISA, can I remind you about basically where this story was formulated on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, where we were talking about lifetime ISAs, and then the brain, the sort of cog started turning in my brain, where I'd been sort of moaning about LISAs being a rubbish product, and then realizing that actually I've started to get FOMO about potentially being too old to open one, and whether I should get one. So Lifetime ISA is a product where you can save for your first home or your retirement into an ISA wrapper. You could both put if you're in a couple, you both put £4,000 a year into your Lifetime ISA, and you get a 25% bonus on your savings from the government. Now, we've talked about it again on this podcast a lot about they're two very different things to be saving towards. But in my viewpoint here, and the reason why this question exists is, well, actually, potentially, if you strip out the home, I'm going to use this for buying a home, and say this is strictly for retirement, then maybe it has a little bit more merit. But there are things, obviously, to consider when doing that. So number one is you can't access it until you're 60, and you can only save into it until you're 50. You can only get that bonus into it until you're 50. So I thought it was an interesting question. Now, before I weighed in any more to this, we did have a listener who emailed me directly about this. I'm just going to call him James, because I haven't told James that I was going to mention his email on the podcast. But it was really interesting, because he was saying, you know, if you've maxed out your pension scheme, you know, where else do you get a 25% risk-free return? He says, I'm using it as a great pension supplement. And then he sent me a screenshot of his lifetime ISA. I love our listeners, and I love our readership, about how kind of open they are about money. You know, there's always that kind of like, it's a taboo to talk about money. Well, I tell you, with our readers and our listeners, it's great. I love how much they share. So thanks, James, really kind. And he showed me, I won't read out what he's contributed and what his returns are, but it got me thinking. I was looking at it and I was like, ah, well done, mate. That looks like good. That is a good pension supplement. So I completely understand it. Now, we obviously took this to experts, and experts rightly make some very good points on this. So we have Janice Dallas here, who's an IFA. She said that the bonus paid by the government of lifetime ISA is a flat 25% for everyone. So if you pay 40 or 45% income tax on some of your income, you stand to get a better bonus by paying more into your pension than a LISA. Also points out that you can only pay into it up to your 50. And that means if you're nearing 40, you'd be able to only pay in up to, well, I say only, you could pay in up to 40 grand with bonuses up to 10 grand. Then at 60, you'd be able to access the money. So I think that's food for thought. And the reason why I kind of, it's been food for thought for me, is because I am reaching that age where I've still got a little bit of time. I've got a couple of years left, but I am reaching that time when, you know, I won't be able to open one for that much longer. And I am pretty much maxing out my pension. Like, I'm very comfortable with the amount that goes into my pension every month. And it's about kind of diversifying away out of that, just reliance on that pension pot. Now, I should also point out here that in my private pension, I am diversified, because I'm not just in the default fund. You know, I've spread my money about into where I see fit. But I haven't ruled it out, Georgie. I haven't ruled it out.
Why don't you just put a quid in, open it up, and then it's there?
Yeah,
then you've
but
not
I mean,
lost a quid, like, rather than just
Well, then what am I going to do? Wait to get that quid until I'm 60? You know,
because
that's the thing. You can't. That's the other thing consider with this. You can't access the money without penalty, and the penalties could be quite severe before you're in. You know, before that 60 mark. So you have to be fully aware that you're going to be locking this up for 20 to 25 years if you're in your late 30s. And as she said, 40 grand with a 10 grand bonus, you then got to rely on some compounding growth that's not going to be that huge compared to what you're probably going to get if you divert that into a pension instead, or potentially a stocks and shares ISA, where you've got more sort of flexibility. So I'm still on the fence, Georgie. You can tell I'm still on the fence. I'm still digesting it. I'm still thinking about it. I'm still mulling it over.
All I will say, and this goes all the way back to the pensions debate at the start, a lot of the complaints that the experts have had about all this speculation about pension changes is that we don't know. We could get a flat rate pension. Pensions may not be as attractive as they once were. They might say that we're going to close all lifetime ISAs. I kind of just think for a quid, while you're at this age, give yourself the time. If you are like on the border of 39, 40, and don't get me wrong, I am no fan of this product, having had to fork out thousands of pounds in a penalty for doing what it was supposed to do, buy a house just for a slightly more expensive house than I was allowed to. However, if you are kind of umming and ahhing for the sake of a quid, I kind of think, meh.
Next time you speak to me, I would have put a pound into a lifetime ISA. We're going to track it. We're going to decide what to.
Why not?
I don't know about that. We'll see.
But, too much.
I do think it's a kind of different way of thinking about the lifetime ISA, though. You know, as in, I've always kind of not been a big fan of it, just because of that penalty element and it being two completely different savings goals. But if you take out one of those kind of thought processes and streamline it into this is just going to be for retirement, and it's going to be a nice little bonus pot for when I turn 60, I could kind of understand it. But at the same time, it probably is just better served if I can put more into my pension, probably going in there. But
so my view on this, and I had this question before I was 40, which was more years ago now, was that basically if you don't own a home, then definitely save into a lifetime ISA for your deposit and hope that you don't get caught out by some of the quirks in there, like buying above the level or, you know, and things like that. If you were going to use it as a retirement fund, then you were probably better off paying into your pension, because you get the same level of tax relief on paying into a pension, and be that in a workplace pension, which obviously the benefits, obviously pay as much into your workplace pension as your employer will either match or, you know, do whatever contributions they do, max that out. After that, you could pay it into a SIP if you just want to choose the investments yourself, and money in a SIP can be run pretty cheaply and you'll get the same tax relief benefit as a basic rate taxpayer. But if you're a higher rate taxpayer, to definitely pay into the SIP or pension rather than the lifetime ISA, because you'll get better tax relief than you will in the lifetime ISA. And that's where I settled. I was just like, well, there's just no point doing this because I'm a high rate taxpayer. So if I want to put extra money into something that's locked away until my retirement years, I might as well put it into a SIP. And actually, a SIP doesn't even lock it away for as long. So that was my thinking.
Love a good debate. Right, Simon, stat of the week. What have you got
right
for me?
Okay, we have some figures from HMRC obtained through a Freedom of Information request by stockbroker InvestEngine, which is an investment platform. There are now more than 10,000 people who have over £750,000 stashed in ISAs. Meanwhile, there are more than 250,000 who have £250,000 in their ISAs, which just goes to show the numbers that have managed to build up substantial pots in their ISAs. Although it should be said, these are still a very small minority of the population, which is also why, if you look at it, right, there's more than 250,000 people with £250,000 in an ISA, right? So, and there's only 10,000 people who have £750,000 in there, which is why would you do that thing, that limit of £500,000? All you're going to do is bring a load of really bad publicity on yourself. For what? To target a relatively very small number of people? I'd file that under pointless.
All right, then. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, if you'd like to get involved in the LISA debate, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.